This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. On the program this afternoon, we take a look back at the Starr investigation. Washington Post journalist Benjamin Wittes is our guest. He's the author of a new book about independent counsel Kenneth Starr's probe into the scandals of the Clinton era. The new book is titled Starr, A Reassessment. Wittes, who interviewed Starr at length for the book, says Starr shouldn't be lionized, nor should he be demonized. He argues that Kenneth Starr was, quote, an ethical lawyer who produced a terrifying probe. He says caricatures of Starr, quoting again, were politically convenient, but they were bad history, or rather no history at all. They represented a kind of cognitive shorthand for values and conduct we admire or abhor. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. If you have questions or comments, give us a call. In the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Benjamin Wittes is an editorial writer for The Washington Post. He writes on matters involving the federal courts, major federal investigations, law, and criminal justice. His book, Starr, A Reassessment, is published by Yale University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Benjamin Wittes, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. You say one of the problems with Kenneth Starr as independent counsel was that he was an inexperienced prosecutor. Maybe to start this afternoon, you'd give us a little background on him.
Well, Starr was his chief experience prior to becoming independent counsel had been as both a judge and as an appellate lawyer. He had been a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals at a very young age, and subsequent to leaving that position, had become Solicitor General in the first Bush administration, after which he joined a law firm where he had a substantial appellate practice. He had never been a prosecutor prior to becoming independent counsel, though he had worked as an advisor to the Attorney General early in the Reagan administration. So he wasn't completely ignorant of the process of federal prosecution. In fact, he had some tangential experience with it and some experience overseeing it, but he had never actually prosecuted a case, nor had he actually conducted an investigation. Now, this doesn't distinguish him particularly from other independent counsels about whom the same can be said. However, it's probably the case that that no independent counsel who had quite as little experience as he had ever found himself in quite as central a firestorm involving this kind of a prosecution of the President of the United States before.
Hmm. Kenneth Starr was not a fan of the statute that gave us the independent counsel. You say he hated it. What was his opposition to it?
Well, it's a fascinating question, and actually it's one of the deep ironies of the whole direction that he took as independent counsel, that he had a long history of principled and well-thought-out opposition to the statute. Starr, like many conservatives, had a aversion to the statute that was rooted in separation of powers concerns. The statute, which was created and passed in the aftermath of Watergate, essentially creates a prosecutor who is not answerable to the rest of the executive branch in a direct or immediate sense and is appointed by a panel of judges. And this is, from a strict separation of powers point of view, a very troubling structural arrangement. And it's one that conservatives were much more attuned to and concerned by initially than were a lot of liberals who were more enthusiastic about the statute. Starr, as an officer in the Justice Department, actually in the early 80s helped the Reagan administration form its opposition to the statute's reauthorization. And as far as I can tell, he never had cause to rethink that or develop any particular affection for it. So it's one of the ironies of I think of his life, that he has become a sort of poster boy for every excess and danger of that statute, about the excesses and dangers of which he was concerned about and aware of long before a lot of other people took them seriously.
Yeah, that is such a big question. Why did he agree to serve?
Well, I think that also has to do, there are other people who have served as independent counsels despite being opponents of the law, and I think the Supreme Court had upheld the law in the late 80s, and it was the law of the land, and, there wasn't a, so the question wasn't then, were we going to have an independent counsel statute? It's whether you were an appropriate person to serve under it, and he made the judgment that he was, and I think to some degree, his concerns about the statute gave him a comfort level with serving under it, in the sense that he would be the same sensitivities that made him oppose it in the first place would enable him, in his judgment, to design structures and to pay attention to those concerns in the course of conducting the investigation that somebody else might not do. So I think it actually, perversely perhaps, made him more comfortable with being independent counsel rather than less.
Mm.
And I'm frankly not sure it was an irrational judgment on his part. I mean, I do think you don't want somebody as independent counsel who has no sense of the dangers that the statute can produce. And we had experiences with that in the past, and I don't think it was a crazy notion for him to see his skepticism about the statute and his awareness of the potential dangers as not a bad thing and perhaps even a good thing. The irony is not, in my judgment anyway, that he took the job. The irony is that having taken the job, he then adopted a vision of the role of the independent counsel that really exacerbated the structural problems that the statute creates.
Yeah, you say something that is key to understanding Starr and his investigation is his vision of the role, his conception of the job of independent counsel. Talk with us about that.
Well, the statute creates a tension in the role, and I think the tension is unavoidable. The tension is between a vision of the independent counsel as a federal prosecutor like any other federal prosecutor who happens to have as his subject a very prominent individual generally in government, and a vision of the independent counsel as a kind of a one-man truth commission. Whose job it is to sort of get and report the story behind the allegation of misconduct by the covered official. Most people who have served as independent counsel have envisioned themselves as a prosecutor. Now, there are some problems with this vision, in the sense that the independent counsel is obliged to write a report, which is something that prosecutors generally don't do. And it has unlimited time and unlimited money in which to conduct this investigation, all of which tend to push you toward a particularly involved and serious investigation. That said, most people who have served under the law have seen their role as simply to mimic the function that the Justice Department would normally perform. Starr saw his role very differently, and he believes that the central mission of the independent counsel was using the tools of federal prosecutors as a kind of an informative function and a function to get and report the truth. And as he put it to me, that the central mission is fact-gathering, and then he wanted along the way to be just and fair. And I think this is a very important dimension in how he conducted, in a lot of the decisions that he made when confronted with two possible options, the more aggressive or the less aggressive, he would tend to choose the one, if there was a ethical step that could be taken that would maximize the chance of his garnering and being able to report the truth. He saw himself as bound, obligated to pursue that. I think this has enormous implications for the way the investigation unfolded and tended to push the investigation, unfortunately, in my judgment, in precisely the wrong direction. I don't think he adopted this vision as a result of what the sort of Starr haters believe, which is that, you know, he was politically motivated or unethical or a zealot out to unseat a president. I do think, however, that the vision is wrong as a matter of law and a matter of history, and had very unfortunate consequences in the course of the investigation that he conducted.
Mm. Now, probably people listening this afternoon to us would, might be asking, well, wait a minute, how could reporting the truth be the wrong thing to do, be the wrong direction?
No, it's a fascinating question. You know, I don't mean to suggest that there's anything improper about the function of truth-seeking, which is, as far as I'm concerned, the most noble thing there is to do in the world. However, it isn't traditionally the prosecutor's function. The truth to a prosecutor is an instrumental value, which is to say that prosecutor's job is to put bad guys in jail. Now, in order to do that, you need to know with a very high degree of accuracy what did and didn't happen. But the prosecutor's function is not to find out the truth for its own sake. And there are many situations in the criminal justice system in which the truth is actively shunned. For example, evidence unlawfully obtained is excluded from court. Privileged material, even if true, is withheld. For example, your conversations with your lawyer or your conversations with your priest are inadmissible. And so the role of truth in the criminal justice system is a complicated one the purpose of which isn't simply expository. Rather, it's to identify whether an individual at a particular moment in time did or didn't satisfy the elements of a criminal offense subject to a standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt and without qualifying for a certain limited set of exceptions. You're talking about, there are many true facts that a prosecutor will decide he doesn't care about, because even if true, they don't really amount to a case that would be worth prosecuting. Now, somebody who is involved in a truth-seeking project, for example, the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, might very well not be concerned with the question of whether individual acts did or did not constitute a criminal offense. So while obviously truth is a very central issue in prosecution, it is getting and disclosing the truth is not centrally what a prosecution is about. And interestingly, both Starr's predecessor, Robert Fisk, and his successor, Robert Ray, make very clear that they did not see their role as that of a truth commissioner. They saw it as a much narrower one as a prosecutor. I can give you a specific example of the way this functions, this differing conceptions of the role functioned in practice, which is the investigation of the death of Vince Foster, who was the deputy White House counsel who committed suicide early in the Clinton administration. Both Fisk and Starr, who took over Fisk's investigation, investigated the death because of the possibility that it may have been linked in some way to the Whitewater affair. Fisk investigated it over the course of about 6 months and produced a report saying this is clearly a suicide and has nothing to do with Whitewater. He described to me this as an effort to establish that there was no crime had taken place, and that once you're 98% sure of that, you don't want to lengthen the investigation for purposes of the other 2%. Starr, however, reopens this investigation and keeps it open for 3 years. And his explanation of that is that he felt an obligation to make sure that conspiracy theorists there were no open questions that hadn't been left unaddressed, and conducted a lengthy grand jury investigation largely for the benefit of history rather than for the benefit of establishing whether or not a crime had taken place and whether or not anybody should be prosecuted. In Starr's defense, you can say, well, he really did manage to silence a lot of the conspiracy theorists. However, it's a legitimate question, and I think he's on the wrong side of it, frankly, as to whether that's really what the grand jury is for.
There were so many elements to the investigation. As you mentioned, he reopened the investigation into the death of Vincent Foster. There was also Whitewater, which you've mentioned, Travelgate, the FBI files, Monica Lewinsky. How did the investigation become so wide-ranging? Was that the reason he reopened the investigation into the death of Vincent Foster? Does it also tell us a lot about how the investigation became so wide-ranging?
To some extent, it does. Now, it is important not to over-blame Starr for this, for the expansions of the investigation. I think he has said publicly that he should not have accepted jurisdiction over more areas than his initial mandate. And I think he's certainly right about that. But it's also the case that the Justice Department shouldn't have requested that he take those extra areas of jurisdiction. And similarly, it's the case, I think, that the Congress shouldn't have created a statutory environment in which that was such an attractive option for all concerned. There were legitimate reasons why, when you have an up-and-running operation that's investigating one person, and then you have a bunch of new allegations that arise about the same person, there's a lot of reasons of convenience why you might give the new matter to the old investigation. That way you don't have to start up a new shop. It saves time. It saves money. And yet it did create a perception and, to some extent, a reality that this was an office that was designed to investigate whatever plausible criminal allegations arose about the Clintons. And I think that was extremely damaging to certainly the public's confidence in the investigation, but also damaging to the investigation's ability to wrap things up in a timely way. And I think that a lot of people, including Starr, have some measure of responsibility for that.
Mm. His predecessor and his successor, did you talk with them about where they might have wrapped it up, how they would have contained it?
Well, it's an inevitably speculative question.
Sure.
It is worth noting that Mr. Fisk stresses the importance of wrapping things up in a timely way and treating these matters as clouds around the presidency that need to be addressed quickly, and that time really is of the essence. Similarly, Ray, the first thing he did, or just about the first thing he did when he took over the investigation, was to lay out a time frame in which he was going to finish all of the pending matters before him, and he very rigorously adhered to that time frame. So it's clear to me that both had a sense of the necessity of expedition that Starr really didn't feel. By contrast, Starr, in the Vince Foster matter, made it clear to the people who were conducting the investigation that he wanted them to be exhaustively thorough and to resolve every question that might arise, and wanted something that they would be able to be proud of 10 years, 20 years down the line, and did not feel that the appropriate thing to do was simply to resolve the criminal questions and leave the rest to historians. That clearly isn't the path that Fisk took on the same question, and I think that Fisk's approach was much more prudent and wiser.
Remind us why he was fired. Why he left the job?
Fisk was removed because Fisk had been appointed by Janet Reno in a period in which the statutory regime had lapsed, and he was when Congress reauthorized the regime in 1994, the three-judge panel that oversees independent counsels then had to appoint someone, and Reno asked that they retain Fisk, and they declined on grounds that because he had been appointed by Reno, he would be perceived as the attorney general's person, and so they removed Fisk and replaced him with Starr.
In hindsight, it's a particularly
unfortunate decision, I think. Fisk was a much more experienced prosecutor. He had an operation that was up and going and that was proceeding apace and resolving matters. Ironically, some of the things that Starr has been criticized for actually had their genesis in Fisk's own investigation. That said, I do think had Fisk been allowed to proceed, that things might have proceeded rather differently. Hmm. Although that's innately speculative and not something that's provable one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Journalist Benjamin Wittes is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's a writer for The Washington Post. He's an editorial writer for The Post. He's written a new book about independent counsel Kenneth Starr and Starr's probe into the scandals of the Clinton era. The book is titled Starr, A Reassessment. It's published by Yale University Press. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. You can join us with a telephone call in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In the book, you say caricatures were drawn of Starr by fans and foes. You say they were politically convenient, but off the mark. The way people viewed him, out to get the Clintons or as a man out to save the Republic, how do those caricatures distort the picture of Kenneth Starr?
Well, they distort it very dramatically and in ways that are both sort of grossly unfair to him and also that I think really impede the discussion of how we should in fact understand what happened over a 2-year period of recent American history. So start with the most prevalent caricature, which is the idea of him as some combination of a politically motivated demon, a sex-obsessed Puritan, and a unethical lawyer who was willing to bend or break whatever rules stood in the way of him and his nefarious goals. Every element of the caricature is either knowably false or at least not demonstrably true. There's no particular reason to regard Starr as an overly partisan or improperly motivated person. He had been the Solicitor General in a Republican administration, but of course, Archibald Cox, the famed Watergate special prosecutor, had been the Solicitor General in the prior Democratic administration. He was, as a judge, known as a sort of a moderate conservative, sort of consensus builder on a court that was, at that time anyway, famously divided. It simply isn't a reflection of the man who had previously been known around Washington. Mm. The idea that he behaved unethically has been rejected by every court that has examined any allegation made against him. The idea that he is a sex-obsessed Puritan is simply a ad hominem that people who didn't like the investigation have made. They've chosen to represent things about what is going on in his inner mind that, as far as I can tell, there's no possible way they could know. On the other side of the equation, the conservative defense of Starr, which presents him as a sort of a savior of the Republic and the sort of polar opposite of the Clintons, is a kind of a white knight fairy tale. It's quite unrealistic. It creates out of him a kind of a cartoon superhero that is very hard to relate to the aspects of the investigation that are genuinely scary, in the sense of a boundless inquest that went on for many years and that had enormous capacity to envelop the political discussion of the entire country. It seems to me that there has to be, at some point, a more mature discussion of what he was doing right and what he was doing wrong. And that's sort of what the book is an attempt to begin.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us now, so let's go to our first caller. A caller on the toll-free line in Northern Illinois. Good afternoon.
Yes. I'm trying to remember some of the things that I noticed during when all of this was happening. But I was wondering about the Kathleen Willey and Julie Hyatt Steele situation. As I understood it, didn't Kathleen Willey come forward and say that Clinton had groped her? And which was unusual, because Clinton's pattern was more seduction than like a physical attack on somebody. So then Julie Hyatt Steele, originally, he spoke to Isikoff, and she said that, she had heard that. And then she changes her story, and the FBI files say Kathleen Willey is totally unreliable. So Starr prosecuted Julie Hyatt Steele. Am I correct on that?
The basic outlines you're describing are correct, yes.
Now, where does that fit in with his truth-seeking?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think the Steele case was kind of an absurd coda to the whole Lewinsky investigation, in the sense that the only person, actually other than a member of Starr's own staff, who faced prosecution as a result of the Lewinsky saga was this obscure woman from Richmond, Virginia. I think that what happened in that case was that Starr's staff became convinced that Steele was lying to them and was maliciously disparaging a central witness that they had in whom they believed. Now, whether they believed in Willey accurately or not is a matter that I will leave to others to judge. However, I think there was a factor in there that was, and this is a prosecution that I personally find very, very difficult to justify.
Now, what about the final report? I never read it, but I had the impression that rather than truth-seeking, it was much more involved with a tobacco lawyer who decided to humiliate as many people as possible and was very heavy on sexual comments that Lewinsky made about Clinton being adept or not adept, and spent a lot of time on the sexual aspect rather than anything connected with Whitewater.
Well, this is now which report are you referring to here? Are you referring to the referral to Congress about Lewinsky, or are you referring to the final report on Whitewater? Because they're actually different reports.
Okay, not the one up by Ray. Are you talking about Ray or Starr report?
Well, the Starr report that was sent to the Hill that triggered the impeachment is the one that has been widely criticized for its salacious sexual details.
Okay, and where in truth-seeking, Starr's compelling interest in truth, where does that fit in with that report?
It's a very interesting question, and I think it actually fits in very centrally with it. The way the Lewinsky investigation was conducted is very hard to reconcile with the way a traditional prosecutor would have handled the Lewinsky investigation.
Okay, and also,
hang on. Let me answer your question.
Yeah.
The traditional prosecutor looks at this case and says, "This is a one witness case. You want to know whether Clinton lied under oath and urged Monica Lewinsky to lie under oath? You got to hear from Monica Lewinsky." And so you try to do an immunity deal with Monica Lewinsky. And if you can't do an immunity deal with Monica Lewinsky, you put her in front of the grand jury anyway, and you get her immunized by statute. But you got to hear from that witness real fast. That's not the way Starr proceeded. What Starr did is he tried to do the immunity deal. When he couldn't do the immunity deal with Lewinsky because of the antics of her then-lawyer, William Ginsburg, he put the whole thing on hold, the relationship with her, and proceeded to litigate a bunch of privileges and try to get to the story by other means. It took him 7 months to hear from his central witness. And when he did hear from her, he then writes a report or delivers a report to Congress that imparts in great detail what happened. Now, I don't think this report is the report of a traditional prosecutor. It's a report of somebody who feels it is his responsibility to explain the story, to explain what happened. I think a traditional prosecutor focuses on the question of what cases he can bring. The truth commissioner gets the story and tells the story to Congress. I think this is a very important example of the truth commission vision and how it distorts the priorities and behavior of the office. Not, again, because of misconduct, not because Starr, as you put it, was a tobacco lawyer, which I don't think had anything to do with it, not because he's a Republican, but because he had a conception of his role that was much broader and much more grandiose than it needed to be, or in my judgment, it should have been.
And then about Whitewater, as I understand it, the prosecutions in Arkansas and all of it, there were people who misrepresented information on a mortgage claim. There are lots of others. But did anybody go to jail for Whitewater?
Well, absolutely. The McDougals and Jim Guy Tucker were both prosecuted by Starr's office in connection with transactions that were very centrally about Madison Guarantee and that involved specifically the relationship with the Clintons. Absolutely.
So now, Guy Tucker, wasn't he like an enemy of Clinton who came, you know, made a lot of accusations that were never substantiated?
No, I think you're confusing him with David Hale.
No. Guy Tucker was also a Democrat who ran against, followed him as governor, but was an enemy.
They were political rivals at one time.
Yeah.
But he was not making allegations against the Clintons in the context of this. He was rather a co-defendant of the McDougals in the original trial.
Let me ask the caller to throw in one last question. I've got somebody else waiting.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. Who was the guy who said you can indict my dog? And they got him in the partner of Hillary Clinton,
Webster Hubbell.
And they got him for overbilling his clients, right?
Well, they indicted Webster Hubbell serially for a bunch of things. It's a subject I treat at length in the book. How one evaluates those prosecutions is a complicated question, and because some of them are more justifiable than others. Webster Hubbell had been a partner of the Clintons, who then became associate attorney general in the Clinton administration and resigned and was subsequently indicted would have been indicted by Fisk's operation, but because Fisk was removed, ended up being indicted by Starr initially.
I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon, a listener who followed that story pretty closely,
yes,
didn't she?
Yeah. Indeed.
Let's talk with another caller, line one, caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Let me preface by saying I'm no fan of Clinton's. And certainly I think there probably were things that he could have been investigated for and possibly prosecuted for, but that because they were so similar to things that the Republicans did, they stayed away from that, especially with fundraising scandals. But that said, you talk about Starr having some grandiose vision, but it seems to me that he was dealing with what I find to be, at least in the context of investigating a presidential administration, trivia. I mean, Iran-Contra and Watergate, these were real constitutional crises. I mean, real tax on democracy. But, this whole business with Monica Lewinsky, while perhaps deplorable, just doesn't seem to be something that should be, stretched out to threaten a presidency. And I contend that, the reason Fisk was gotten rid of was because he wasn't going to let the Republicans stretch that thing out to the absurdity that they did, and they knew it, and so they brought in the guy they did.
Is that a question or a statement?
Well, I think it's a challenge somewhat to your premise, but it you said that he had this grandiose vision, but it seems to me that he was just mucking around in little stuff and not really going after anything that rose to a level that, justified the kind of scope of investigation that he took part in.
Well, let me make a few observations in response. The first is that when I said he had a grandiose vision, what I said was he has a grandiose vision of his own role. Now, a prosecutor doesn't get to choose the subject matter, particularly an independent counsel that he investigates. He's appointed to investigate a particular set of allegations, and he has a limited jurisdiction. The campaign finance matters to which I assume you were referring were never part of Starr's jurisdiction, and he had no authority to look at them. I don't know whether he had interest in looking at them or not, but they were entirely beyond the scope of his mandate. So it's a little bit unfair to blame him for the picayune nature of the subject matter that he was investigating. However, it is not unfair, in my judgment, to blame him or hold him responsible for, given the picayune nature of the subject matter he was looking at, not wrapping it up in an expeditious fashion. It was not his judgment to make that Whitewater should not be investigated. And by the way, I think there were issues in Whitewater that needed to be investigated. Whether they needed to be investigated for 7 years is a separate question. I think you're, to some extent, you're conflating two distinct issues. On one of which, your criticism is I think fair, and on the other one, it might be fair, but it's not properly laid at Starr's door. If the judgment is that the FBI files matter was too trivial to investigate, that's Janet Reno's problem. She was the one who referred it to him to investigate. If the judgment is that the FBI files matter should have been wrapped up earlier, I agree with you completely.
Does the caller want to follow-up?
I just wonder how you get from Whitewater to Lewinsky. And I also wonder if, the Bush administration, the first one or the current one, could withstand the kind of scrutiny that the Clinton administration was subjected to. I find the whole thing really astonishing and disgusting.
Well, your first question, how do you get from Whitewater to Lewinsky, is a fascinating one, and it's one that I think we need to think about as a society, because we're going to have these investigations. We don't have the independent counsel law anymore, but we will have independent public integrity investigations, and we need to think about how to cabin them and how much we want to cabin them. It's an interesting question to me, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. What do you do when you're the independent counsel and you're investigating a particular set of matters, and somebody walks through your door making substantial, if true, allegations of criminal conduct about the target of your investigation or the subject of your investigation, but that aren't directly related to the allegations that you've been empowered to investigate. Is the proper thing to do to go to the Attorney General and say, hey, this has come up, we need to look at it? Or is the proper thing to do to say, I don't have any time for you, go home, go somewhere else? And what are the consequences if you say the latter? I mean, what would have happened if Linda Tripp had, if STAR's office had just said, sorry, no need to, we don't need to talk to you about this, this is outside our bailiwick, go somewhere else? The likely consequence is that she would have gone somewhere else and there would have been a different independent counsel appointed. Would that have been a good thing or a bad thing? I'm not sure I know the answer to that question.
Yeah, that's a very good question. The caller has hung up and is listening, so he's unable to answer it also. And also we're drawing down on our time here very rapidly. To sum up, or to wrap up, how does Kenneth Starr see his performance? You interviewed him for 10 hours for this book. What's his assessment of his performance?
You know, there are areas in which he has acknowledged that he made mistakes. He has said he shouldn't have accepted jurisdiction over more areas, which is exactly the issue that I was just asking the caller about. He has said that he should have, you know, he's been criticized for allegedly leaking stuff to the press. His self-criticism is that he did not talk to the press enough, that he didn't explain his investigation well enough as it was going on. But basically, in my view, his whole demeanor with respect to self-assessment is that he's very convinced of his own rightness and that he is convinced that he did his job, he understood it properly, and he did it to the best of his ability, and he got and disclosed the truth. And that, I think he has a high degree of comfort with what he did. And I don't think, you know, I don't know what he stays up nights thinking about, if he stays up nights thinking about, but I don't think he is racked with self-doubt.
Has he read the book?
Well, he responded. There, an excerpt of the book appeared in a magazine called Legal Affairs, and he responded to the excerpt and has wrote a response in defense of the Truth Commission vision of the statute. So he is at least familiar with and conversant with the argument.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go look for that article. In Legal Issues, right? I know
Legal Affairs.
Legal Affairs.
A new magazine being published out of the Yale Law School.
Okay, very good. We're out of time. Sorry to say, we had one more caller. We just couldn't squeeze in this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're out of time. Benjamin Wittes, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Fascinating topic.
Thanks for having me.
His book, STAR, A Reassessment. The book is published by Yale University Press.